Hello, and welcome to Some Other Sphere, a podcast exploring our strange world, one conversation at a time, hosted by Rick Palmer. My guest for this episode is Laura Lewis Barr. Laura is an award-winning filmmaker who specialises in the medium of stop motion to create short movies inspired by myths, fairy tales, and the ideas of people such as Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell. In her films, she uses dolls to portray an eclectic array of characters and does all of the costuming, set design, filming and editing. Her films are part of a larger project called Psyche's Cinema. Prior to her filmmaking, Laura was a graduate student in clinical depth psychology, and her interest in Jungian psychology is an important part of her filmmaking projects. In the interview, I start by talking with Laura about the origins of the idea for Psyche Cinema and what drew her to the medium of stop motion filmmaking. We then discuss some of the mythic and psychological themes she has explored in her films, the importance and value of mythic ideas, how they persist in modern human culture, and can help us better understand paranormal phenomena. Laura was a delight to talk with. Enjoy! Laura, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Rick. Thank you so much.
To begin with, just talk a little bit about your background in filmmaking and psychology and what led you to start the Psyche Cinema project.
Yes, well, from my childhood on, I have been in the theater. I've done theater my whole life, but at the same time, I was studying psychology as a possible way to make a living. So those two threads have, you know, been in my life for decades and in my study. Eventually, I decided not to be a therapist, even though I started formal study for that and continued with the theater. And I taught theater and directed and did that. And then more recently, maybe 2010, I got involved in a film project and really saw how wonderful film is too. I love theater and always will, but film lasts forever. And so I started exploring that, and all of my continual studies in psychology merged right about the time of the pandemic, just before, where I started making stop motion as a way to learn how to use my camera that I bought. And I thought fairy tales were a really great way to explore stop motion with the dolls I had assembled. And then all of my studies in psychology, there was a lot of emphasis on fairy tales as being a useful tool for studying the psyche. So it all just sort of came together, all of my passions, around 4 or 5 years ago.
Right, okay. And what drew you to stop motion filmmaking? That's the style that you use. How did that come about?
Yeah, so I bought a camera and I realized that live action felt very daunting to me. And also, you know, the scale of stop motion, literally the scale, but also in terms of being able to make a film, I make films in my basement for really almost nothing. And so stop motion just became, it's fun, it fits my personality somehow, and it became just the right vehicle for telling these stories. And for the fact, I did a lot of the early films during the pandemic, when we were all locked down. So I guess stop motion, like if you gave me a lot of money to make a live action film right now, I don't know that I would want to do it, because I've fallen in love with sort of the the craft and the fantasy of stop motion, and there's so many things about it that are magical to me.
Yeah, I agree. I'm a big fan of that medium. There's just something charming about it. I find it's quite a intimate medium. It feels very personal. Like, you can tell that it's something it's quite a tactile medium, I guess, because, you know, the person is moving the figures for each frame, and it just has a disarming quality to it.
I love what you're saying, and it strikes me that in this age of AI and so much animation is now digital and computer generated, there is something kind of revolutionary about the meticulous, time-consuming technique of stop motion. It does push against sort of the way society moves these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just thinking, some of my earliest childhood memories are watching films like Jason and the Argonauts and Clash of the Titans, you know, and they involved, you know, Ray Harryhausen and his work. And I didn't find the connection until just now, but I mean, those are also mythic stories, and those two films are some of my favorites. The skeleton scene in Jason and the Argonauts, and the scene where they wake up like a gigantic iron statue is kind of breathtaking, really. And it's all due to that medium.
Yeah. And I think as we keep circling around this, the medium and the tales themselves seem to work really well, because they're both fantastic in terms of fantasy, and the realism, I think, gets in the way sometimes. And when we can do something that defies realism, and you might have noticed in my work, I don't animate the mouths, so there's even more kind of uncanny stillness. So that uncanny quality, I think, is so useful when we get into fairy tales and myths.
Definitely. So the name Psyche Cinema, I'm interested in that too. Was that something that came to you quite early in the process, or not?
Probably not. You know, I'm so terrible about rebranding myself when I when I grow into new ideas or new insights, I should say. I'm a decades, many decades long student of Carl Jung's work. And so it's sort of a signal toward that inspiration of the work, that I really, everything I do, people don't have to see it that way, but that's sort of where I come from, that these stories illustrate what's happening in the psyche. His great word, well, it's not his word, but he uses that word to talk about the soul of us. It's more than mind, it's more than spirit. It's sort of the unconscious and the conscious parts of us together.
And it's also the name of a being from Greek mythology. Was that intentional, or is it just a happy coincidence?
Yeah, so I think Jung and Jungians would interpret that story, Psyche and Cupid's story, as representing the human soul, maybe. I mean, all of this is so multidimensional that to latch onto any one meaning is like talking about a dream. There are so many possible meanings, but Psyche in that original or that Greek myth could stand for the human soul.
So what was the first film that you made, and was that an idea that you had for a while, or did you find that you had a story that came up spontaneously?
So my very first film and my very first experiment with stop motion was called The Doctor's Last Day. And it was a comedy that came forward from I guess, as everything does, my own struggles around friendship. And it's a comedy where four different friends are complaining about each other to a therapist who has a drinking problem. And it's silly and it's crude because I really didn't know what I was doing at all. But you know, there is something lovely about that first try when you have absolutely no experience, but lots of, innocence. And so, yeah, that was my first film, and it was screened at a film festival celebrating Freud. And I got to talk to a bunch of psychoanalysts who had watched it. It was pretty trippy. But yeah, that was my first film. That was just written by me, just not based on a fairy tale.
Okay, yeah, I watched that. I really enjoyed it. So what sort of ideas were you exploring with that first film?
I think, you know, I've studied psychology for a long, long time. I've studied and taught emotional intelligence. I'm just fascinated by how we as humans think and project on each other and I guess the main theme of that one was how, especially women in my life, myself and other women, it feels like we all have a hard time being honest with each other and we avoid conflict. And so it was my humorous exploration of that kind of refusal to have conflict and it being channeled in these sessions with this poor doctor who's way over his head and doesn't know how to deal with all these women.
Okay. So after that point, did your film sort of focus more on ideas from psychology, sort of ideas from Jungian psychology in particular?
Yeah, I kind of go back and forth. I think the majority of what I'm doing is fairy tales and a lot of them have been explored in Jungian writings. These fairy tales have been analyzed, and I get inspired by that analysis, but I don't get married to it. So right now I'm working on the fairy tale Snow White and Rose Red. A lot of people know that tale. I didn't. It features a bear. And I'm really tripping on it in ways that I haven't read in any of the analysis that I read. So for me, because I've done so much personal work with my dreams and Jungian analysis of fairy tales, I try as much as I can now as I engage with a tale to find my own personal relationship. So in this tale, Snow White and Rose Red, there's Snow White and her sister and a bear and an angry dwarf. Those are the characters. And so if we look at it like a dream, or if we look at it, yeah, as an act of imagination, as a psychological state within ourselves, then what part of me is the bear? What part of me is the angry dwarf? And what parts of those need to be maybe supported? What parts of those of myself need to be like managed or maybe shut off? Or so we're talking about internal parts, and so I like to explore that within myself, and then fantasize about how to invite others to explore that. And then my muse is the comic muse, Thalia. I've always been attracted to comedy and the things that comedy does, which is to poke at our cherished ideas and really kind of bring them down. And then I guess the last thing to say is that I think all artists work from their unconscious. I think that's just a part of being an artist. And I'm very consciously wanting to do that too. So I'm not always, I think, fully conscious of what I'm doing. And a lot of times I only discover later what I did. That's kind of a long answer.
No, it's great. So would that almost be like being in an altered state?
Sure. I think when we're working art, doing art, and in the broadest sense of that word, then yeah, I think we do. I do enter an altered state if I'm lucky. And I think one of the things I try to do in my work is to go where I'm most unsure or where I'm afraid or where I'm uncomfortable, because I know there's a lot of goodness there. That's where my unconscious stuff is. And so like in this one, which I'm calling at the moment, I'm calling it Berserk, which comes from the idea of the berserker and being taken over by the bear energy. There have been times when I've been working on this project where I come to a wall and go, I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't know if I'm on the right track. I think I've hit a block and maybe I have to totally get rid of this project. And then thankfully, so far anyway, I'm finding my way through to deeper insights, because if it doesn't interest me, if I'm not engaged and kind of surprised and delighted, then why make it? Nobody else will be surprised or delighted. So I have to keep finding that for myself in the work.
Hmm. Talking there about the bear and sort of channeling the energy of that creature, that sounds almost like a spiritual practice or a form of magic. Have you, since you started making these films, how has that changed your perception of these sorts of ideas and themes that you're engaging with? Has it changed, or is it just helped you understand it more or not?
No, I think you've hit it. It is a form of magic, and Jung would call it active. Well, Jung talked about active imagination as something that we do. Our imaginations, all of our imaginations, are a form of magic, and we can enter into them and I believe make changes. I've experienced making changes in my daily reality by going into the imaginal realm, and that's something that Jungians do, and Gestalt and other people that do psychology do. So yes, working with these films is sort of a prolonged active imagination. It's kind of staying for months in this meditation on themes. Marie-Louise von Franz is the person who worked with Jung, and her specialty was fairy tales. And she and others say they are the best description of psychology and the archetypes of all of our psychology. And so when we kind of wrestle and with a fairy tale and explore it, we're exploring sort of the architecture of our own minds.
Mm, yeah, there's a quote on your website where Carl Jung describes fairy tales as the anatomy of the psyche.
Exactly.
Can you just talk a little bit more about that concept? I'm really interested in it. I just want to try and get a better handle on what he means by that.
Sure. Well, so, you know, the psyche, we can say there's the ego and there's the part of us that we identify with, which is just, Jung talked about it like a cork floating on the ocean. The ocean is all of the collective unconscious and our personal unconscious. And the cork floating is the I, the me. So it's really small. And the other parts of our unconscious, the shadow, you might have heard that term, or the animus. There are different terms for parts of our unconscious that erupt in us in certain behaviors or moods. And fairy tales, one view of a fairy tale might be that they express, or they express these parts of us. So we can analyze them like we would a dream. Oh, the bear in this fairy tale might relate to my own aggression that I repress as part of my shadow. And maybe if I engage with my own aggression more, I can find a healthy way to be with it and to let it be useful to me so that I'm not a passive victim all the time. So that's one example. And then I think so a lot of Jungians also think of fairy tales as the anatomy of the psyche of a nation or a culture. And so looking at a fairy tale might tell us about the struggles within a particular culture. So it could be micro or macrocosm. And I should say at this point, I am not an analyst. I am only a person who loves this work so much, and I've studied it for so long that I just want to share it. I'm sort of a born again Jungian. It's really helped me in my life, and I like to share it with others. But it's not easy. It's not easy for me to explain, and I think it's not easy work. It's certainly work that requires a lot of time.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I can fully understand that. Something I find interesting about psychology is that it's a relatively new science, if you want to call it a science, yeah. I guess. And it feels like before psychology, the ideas that it covers, it seems especially Jungian psychology, they would be handled in through ideas like philosophy or mysticism or things that we would probably call occult. I mean, do you find that having an interest in psychology now, is that apparent when you, in your own research and the own work you've done? And is it something that is acknowledged, or is psychology very much seen as a sort of a science of the mind?
Well, in the U.S., that's all I can speak to, but in the U.S., Jung and his work isn't really taught in psychology departments. And I think he has been pretty vilified as being a cult and as not being scientific, which is ironic because I think so much of the work that he did in his life ended up being sort of the basis of a lot of things that have been useful in the world, like even just personality types, extroversion, introversion, all of that, and certainly dream work. But he is, I mean, that's why I love his work so much, is that he straddles so much. And for me, and again, I think this is why scientists often don't like him, is he, for me, has been the bridge between the secular and the religious viewpoint. And I think we need that bridge more than ever in the world. And Joseph Campbell's work also was a bridge like this for me. And I think if we don't embrace the mythic element of our psychology, then Jung struggled with the whole Nazi phenomenon, you know, and how it related to myth, and the myth kind of overtaking a culture. And I see that happening in the U.S. with, you know, what happens in certain groups that get so sort of overwhelmed with an archetypal kind of reality. And the scientific left in the United States doesn't know how to deal with it. I've just jumped into deep water there.
No, that's really interesting. I noticed that you mentioned Joseph Campbell is an inspiration for your work and someone you're very interested in. I only have a sort of a basic knowledge of him. I know that the hero's journey is very much the thing that he's probably best known for. Can you just talk a little bit about that and how it might apply in a sort of a psychological context?
Joseph Campbell introduced me to the idea that there's a mythic undercurrent to our lives, and it gets expressed in religions all over the world and in art. And to live a full life, we want to engage with the mythic pattern that is part of, you know, Jung might call it archetypal. So to take our own hero's journey, that's what we're being called to do constantly. And your journey and mine and everybody else's is unique. Campbell used to love to tell the story that in the Arthur stories, in the King Arthur stories, and the Knights of the Grail, each of them were told to enter the forest at the darkest place where there was no path. Because if you found a path, you were walking somebody else's path. You had to go where there was no path. And I know in my own life that these mythic stories feel true. Like doing psyche cinema, it can be frustrating and scary for me because there is no path. I'm making it up. I don't have anybody else to sort of tell me what to do and if I'm on the right track or not. So it's very life-giving and exciting and scary. It's all the things that these stories are. And the stories, whether it's a myth, a fairy tale, a legend from King Arthur, they all kind of point to the way to live. And sometimes they're cautionary tales and the ways not to live. But in any case, they're teaching, they can be teaching us how to live. And I think when I talk to people about my films and fairy tales in general, people that I talk to can be very frustrated because they say to me, I don't understand these tales. They're so bizarre. And yes, like a dream, the ego doesn't always understand, but maybe the unconscious does. And so maybe there's always teaching going on, even when we don't appreciate the teaching that's going on. And the culture is desperate for this, and that's why the fantasy genres have exploded within the last couple decades, it seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, in the West, in, you know, in the Europe and Americas, mainstream culture is quite materialistic as well, isn't it? So I can understand how people are probably encouraged to think this way about myths and the value that they have and what they represent.
You mean that they don't have value?
No, I think that myths are probably seen a lot of the time as stories, but, you know, obviously from the work that you've done and the films that you've made, they have more of a value than that. They're these stories that don't have a human author. They've been with us for as long as humans have been around, I guess. And I think in modern culture, the term mythic can mean not real, whereas mythic doesn't mean that. It just means mythic.
You're so right. It's ironic that myth in our modern culture means untrue, whereas I see it as always true and always happening.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's something that's I find very interesting. In the cultures where these myths come from, so ancient Greece or Norse myths, there are myths across the planet. What role do you think that they served in those times, the times that they come from? Because a lot of people will sort of now read a story in a book, but I'm guessing that back then, obviously, there weren't books. It was more of an oral storytelling tradition. From your own research and your own interest in this, in these subjects, do you have an idea in your own mind about the role that they served and how these stories were transmitted?
Great question. I think back in the medieval times or earlier times when people didn't necessarily think as literally as we do, and they were surrounded by mythic imagery in churches or temples or in the art forms, and science wasn't around to explain everything. So Jung talks about how in medieval times, the alchemists were projecting their psychology out into experiments on lead and that their experiments on lead to turn into gold were really ways of projecting their own inner psychological work. And I think maybe these stories, these fairy tales in all cultures were that, ways of projecting what was happening internally, psychologically, in story form. And von Franz and others have talked about how maybe somebody in a culture had a big dream that felt very important, and that became a story that was told. And maybe some of the myths emerged in that way, but that the unconscious and the conscious mind maybe wasn't so distinct from each other, and there was more of a flow. This is a guess of mine based on what I read.
I think that's a really interesting take on it. I agree. That's something I think about too, is that were those boundaries, were the distinctions between the conscious and the unconscious and the subconscious, I mean, if they weren't as distinct as we think they are now, it feels like that has interesting implications for how those cultures perceive the world around them. Absolutely. Yeah. And as well, you're talking about dreams there. I know from speaking to a previous guest that dreams were very important in ancient Greek culture, for one. And so, yeah, I think that's a really interesting insight. And do you feel like myths are still, that myth-making process is still prevalent now? I mean, I'm guessing with things like new characters in books and comic book heroes, there is still that myth-making process. Do you think it's the same process as was happening in ancient times?
You have such great questions. I don't know. I wonder, because our world changes so rapidly, like the changes even within my own generation, my own life, I mean, how much has changed, that how do we create a myth that fits the world we live in? I don't know, but Campbell and Jung, well, a couple of things. Jung used to say a lot, what myth are you living? Like, find out what myth you're living, and that can help you navigate one's life. Campbell would say, we need to create a new myth in order to navigate the world we're in. And he said that when the astronauts went to the moon and saw the Earth for the first time, that it was a mythic moment of seeing the oneness of the world, and that maybe that needs to be the new myth. And maybe the internet is leading us toward this kind of global myth that that will help us navigate what we face. I don't know if it's that is like the question your aunt's asking, I think is such a great one. And it's confusing, and I'm contradicting myself now because I say there's so much change happening. And at the same time, we are still the ancient mind. We still have the ancient mind in us. We still have those archetypes of the Greeks in us. And so I think that is part of the struggle of our world these days is the mind, the psyche that developed over millennia and over evolutionary times is now being bombarded with, well, we have the power of the gods. We have the power of the Greek gods. We can fly. We can move through time. And yet we don't have the psychology of the gods. And so we get, I mean, the Greeks were always warning us about hubris and getting too, I think we all suffer from a sort of hubris in the world right now, and we have the power of a god. So it's scary times. And so now I have to ask both of us this question, what myth helps us navigate these times? Do you have something that helps guide you?
Oh, that is a good question. I'm not sure, really. I think maybe if there was a character that would inspire me, who I think sort of sets an example, I'm not sure. Maybe someone like Samwise Gamgee in Lord of the Rings, because he's a good guy, you know, like he's a good friend and he's really important to that story. And ultimately, I think it's more sort of things like looking for happiness rather than status. That's where I would look. Stories that help me focus on that. If I gave it some more thought, I could probably give you a better answer. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of the podcast. I have a favour to ask, if that's okay. Once the episode is finished, if you can leave a rating, a short review, and maybe even share it on social media, I'd be very grateful. They're all brilliant ways to promote some other sphere, to help people like yourself find it and increase listenership. And now, back to the episode.
Well, for myself, you know, I said Jung is the bridge between the secular and the religious, and I'm going back to Catholic Mass after 40 years of being away. And the only way I'm going back is because of Jung and Campbell and how I can take the story of death and resurrection and apply it to myself every day. And I guess what dies and what rises within me. And I guess I think culturally it would help us if we worked with that ancient death resurrection pattern more, because we're afraid of death and we don't deal with physical death and psychological losses we don't know how to deal with. And anyway, so easy for me to get on a soapbox, I'm afraid.
No, it's really interesting. If you want to expand on that more, please go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, when we think about the most ancient mythological stories, they're either about their creation stories, usually, and a lot of them also are death resurrection stories. So Osiris for the Egyptians and Christ and a zillion more that I don't know. And so we're coming toward Easter and this pattern of moving from winter into spring. And a lot of the fairy tales also deal with this transformation. Like in a fairy tale, one of the common themes is for a character to be bewitched, and then the character has to do different things and gets help from different allies and eventually is transformed from maybe the animal it was bewitched to a prince or however. And I think those are all kind of death resurrections. So for myself, I mean, I think it's always good to try to take it back to my own life. That's the only way this stuff becomes meaningful. So for myself, what needs to die are old ideas about who I am, or what needed to die for me early on was how I was patterned to be the good girl. And that really didn't serve me. And that was really bad for me. And that was a bewitchment. So that's sort of an example of what can feel like a death as I discard these old patterns that feel sacred in the psyche because they were laid down in childhood. And then I'm born into something that's bigger and better and wider. It makes, like, the best definition of psychology, a healthy psychology or philosophy or religion is, does it allow more life, more freedom, more openness to the world and everyone in it, or does it make me go in the other direction?
It's really interesting that you're talking about bewitchment, and I guess social conventions and can feel like that, can't they? Like fitting in with a social convention, and
right
to an extent where it makes you unhappy or it's not the person that you really are. That I think that's a really interesting analogy for that sort of thing, and the way cultures work. And I guess we're getting back into the roles that myths serve and their original purpose, but it does feel like that might be something that's going on there.
I agree. I think that the culture at large is putting lots of pressure on us all the time. And just to live an authentic life is a heroic journey these days. There's lots and lots. And I'm afraid with AI and other, you know, internet realities, that maintaining our own truth and staying true to ourselves, that does become a mythic battle.
Yeah, absolutely. Another myth that I like is the myth where Persephone is abducted by Hades, and that myth is sort of it's seen as an analogous to the season. So for a part of the year, the fertility goddess, I think it's Demeter, is in Hades as part of this deal. And I understand that quality to it, that it's an explanation for why we have autumn and winter, and then back in spring, you know, things start to grow again. But it also has its own value as that story and those characters within that story.
It's a great story. I think you're right. I think it does work on a lot of levels. And for me, what I see in it, and it reminds me of many fairy tales, is it's the story of the innocent Persephone, who's picking flowers, and she's the maiden, and she's really an image for me of innocence. And she is taken down and loses her innocence. And I think it's a journey that a lot of fairy tales take us on. And it's a journey I personally have taken in my life that I think is a really valuable psychological journey, because innocence is my opinion is it's not the best psychological state to stay in. It's maybe great for little kids, but as an adult, it may not be the best place to be psychologically.
I think with that myth as well, there's the Eleusinian Mysteries, a sort of a mystery school in Greece where people would have days of rituals and to sort of have mysteries revealed to them. It just goes to show that the role that they served in that culture was a very important one.
Yeah, I was reminded recently that if you were sick in ancient Greece, the doctor might tell you to go to the theater for catharsis to be cured. Isn't that amazing? I love that.
No, that is great. That because now, I mean, now we understand that word, but I guess we don't appreciate what it meant originally. Literal catharsis, I guess, like a something that could be almost be prescribed, judging by what you're saying there.
Yeah.
I mean, that would make a great short film.
Interesting.
Yeah, that'd be very interesting. Great. So something I did want to talk to you about is the work of Carl Jung and his ideas are something that crops up quite frequently when I talk to my guests. And, you know, I talk to my guests often about subjects that would be considered paranormal. And, you know, with what we've been talking about with myths and the more occult aspects of some of Jung's ideas and the power of stories, I just wanted to get your opinion on the nature of the paranormal and what that might serve culturally. The more I think about it and the weird things that people encounter, some of those encounters have the quality of a mythic story or they serve something, they serve a purpose for the person that's experiencing them. Or even sometimes it feels like maybe a person's been caught up in someone else's story, perhaps. The high strangeness of some encounters is, from your perspective, in America, for example, with something like Bigfoot, are those encounters perhaps an emergence of something mythic into American culture?
Well, Jung wrote a paper about UFOs toward the end of his life. And my memory of it was that he saw it as an emergence. He saw it as a symbol of wholeness. It's a circular mandala. So he thought that people seeing UFOs, my memory is that he thought that was a good sign, not a bad sign, of a psychological emergence of a unifying image. And when he was young, when Jung was younger, one of his first things that he explored was the occult, and he had a cousin who did seances, and he was exploring sort of the psychology of what was happening in these events. And I think, and he had in his life paranormal events, and I think for Jung, a lot of it had to do maybe with the collective unconscious, this idea, again, that there's this unconscious, there's our personal unconscious, but then there's the unconscious of the planet and all the people on it that maybe some of us tap into at various times and have these paranormal experiences. I mean, we don't really have words, good words for all of this anyway, to talk about it. Jung was also had a friendship and correspondence with the physicist Pauli. His first name is I'm not remembering Pauli's first name right now, but he was a guy that was associated with quantum physics, and Jung was exploring synchronicity. And so, you know, all of these dimensions of reality may have explanations in physics and psychology, and Jung was exploring all of this. For me, it's enough to just say, I love the mystery. I embrace it. I personally don't need to understand it. I do. I don't have a problem personally going, there's levels of reality that I can't explain, but certainly synchronicity as being one thing that that Jung said, we can't ignore these quote unquote coincidences that are happening that feel mystical or spiritual or occult. You know, why is it that I go to pick a tarot card and it's exactly what I need right then? Synchronicity was the way he explained that. And I'm getting way out of my pay grade now to explain that.
No, that was a really interesting answer. From my own perspective, what I think about when, you know, when I read about an encounter someone has had or something from the past, a famous case from the past, that's very strange. It feels as though somehow, perhaps, and it's interesting that you talk about mystery. I think mystery is really important. It does almost feel like something like the dream world, that whatever you want to call that realm, the unconscious realm, there are plenty of names for it, makes its presence felt more in the material realm. But for some reason, I don't know why it does that or if it does that really, but it feels like, especially when things get really weird, that it's for some reason that realm is more present in the waking world. And then in addition to that, there are things like that famous film of the Bigfoot in California. Now, that was probably a guy in a suit, but that whole thing now has a life of its own. That whole story is still really interesting, and it, you know, got people thinking about that creature. And I know in Chicago as well, a few years ago, there was some like Mothman sightings. I think they've mostly been explained, but even so, it's still a story that can capture the imagination of someone, can't it? And I'm just, when I think about those aspects of the power of stories and the trueness of myths, which you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, those things for me seem, if I was going to try and have a theory about what the paranormal is, I don't think there's an answer really, but if I was going to give a theory, I think it's something to do with the power of stories and our connection to them and our role in them.
I love that. I love everything you said. I thought your explanation felt very Jungian, or something Jung might say. And when I think about Bigfoot, I think, you know, what is it in the culture that is longing for the wild man? And I think it feels clear to me. I mean, it's like interpreting, as you were saying, interpreting a dream, interpreting daily life as a dream. So the wild man shows up, and I think personally that we're desperate. We desperately need that wild man in our overly civilized culture. And we need to be in touch with that wild man figure, like the bear. And maybe that's why, whether or not it's real, quote unquote real, it shows up and people are fascinated and compelled and transfixed by it, because it's serving a need.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Laura, this has been a really wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast.
Oh, yes, it was wonderful. Thank you, Rick, so much.
If people want to find out more about yourself and your wonderful films and all that stuff, how best do they do that?
Psyche Cinema, one word, PSYCHES. PsycheCinema.com is probably the best way to find me and all my social media and all the films.
Perfect. Well, I'll make sure to put all that information in the show notes. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you for listening to my conversation with Laura. I think that her work is really interesting and a rather unique way to depict fairy tales and mythic stories, and explore the roles they have in human consciousness. Her films are available to watch on the Psyche's Cinema website, which I heartily recommend doing if you enjoyed this episode. It would be brilliant if you could also rate it and leave a short review wherever you listen, as it really helps to promote the podcast and grow an audience. Sharing it on social media or even just telling a friend is really helpful too. You can follow Some Other Sphere on X and Blue Sky and subscribe on most of the well-known podcast platforms. You can also support the upkeep of the podcast with a donation via Ko-fi. Details on how to do that are in the show notes. If you'd like to email me here at SphereHQ, the address is someothersphere@gmail.com. It'd be lovely to hear from you with your thoughts about an episode you've recently listened to or suggestions for future guests and topics. Until next time, be safe and well, and I hope you'll join me again soon for another episode of Some Other Sphere.